Andreas Krenmeyer joins me this week to discuss his new book on Vienna Lager. This is Beersmith Podcast number 219.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 219, and it's late July 2020. Andreas Krenmeyer joins me this week to discuss his new book on Vienna Lager. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They're currently offering 20% off their All Access subscription pass, with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also the new Brew Commander, the new complete brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller with exact precision and the ultimate in flexibility. Whether integrated or freestanding, the Brew Commander offers automated step mashing, boil timers, and amazing advanced settings. Whatever your setup, the Brew Commander offers precision temperature control with perfect repeatability. Command your brew day with the new Brew Commander from Blickman Engineering. To order yours today, go to blickmanengineering.com for more information. Again, that's blickmanengineering.com. And finally, I urge you to give Beersmith free brewing software a try. I recently released the 3.1 desktop update, which includes improved data storage, additional dry hop options, new mash pH models, add-ons, and much more. To download your free 21-day trial, go to beersmith.com today. Again, that's beersmith.com. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today, my guest is Andreas Krenmeyer. He joins me to discuss his new book on Vienna Lager. Andreas is a software developer, homebrewer, and amateur beer historian who lives in Berlin, Germany. Originally from Austria, his focus is German and Austrian beer styles. Andreas, it's great to have you here. How are you doing today?
I'm great. How are you?
I am excellent. It's a beautiful day here in Clifton, Virginia. How are things in Berlin?
Slightly rainy, but other than that, it's good.
Well, we got a good connection, and I appreciate you joining me today from Berlin. I understand, though, that you actually grew up in Austria. Is that right?
That's right. I was born and raised in Austria, and in 2009, I moved to Berlin due to my job as software developer. Have been living in Berlin since then.
So if we dive into your beer history, I understand that you grew up sampling a lot of Austrian beers, but some German beers as well, right?
Yeah, you could say so.
So how did that turn into an interest in historical beers?
I would say, like, when I grew up drinking beers, or legal drinking age in Austria is 16, and I started drinking at that age. Beer was really, like, I would say fairly monotonous. It's mostly pale lagers, the occasional Bavarian wheat beer. So it has not been sophisticated at that time.
So similar perhaps to the US, where before the 90s, basically all we had was very light lagers, pretty much.
It's pretty much that. Thinking back, the main style that was by far the most common is Austrian Märzen. So it sounds like the Bavarian Märzen that the amber colored
the Oktoberfest beer, right?
Yeah, but the Austrian one is actually, it's kind of like a Bavarian Helles, but a little bit more bitterness. It's really hard to describe because it doesn't fit into any like typical beers how you would find them in beer style guidelines. Mm-hmm. But that's by far the most common beer. And I when I met my wife in 2011, so she's from the UK, she introduced me into a whole new perspective of beer with the whole British cask ale and pop culture. And then around the same time, there was also this craft beer boom in Berlin as one of the first places in Germany. And so we started looking into home brewing. And we basically brewed all the styles that we were interested in, but we couldn't get. And at the same time, I've always been quite interested in history. Where I'm from in Austria, you know, you're very much surrounded by it. Where I'm from specifically from Linz by the River Danube. There's about 2,000 years of continuous settlement history. So you know, you always run into something historic, some artifact, some historic building.
So I mean, are you a closet historian as well? Are you interested in just history in general? I actually read a tremendous amount of history.
It's just a general interest. I'm not really focusing on anything, but I would say I generally like reading about it, learning more about it, understanding more of the wider context. That's just a fun thing.
And so how'd you get into Vienna lagers or Vienna history, Vienna beers specifically? Because as you mentioned, I guess most of the modern examples are pretty uniform, right?
So the thing was when we started homebrewing, I simply started looking into historic beer books. And what was around, I found some English language books from the late 18th, early 19th centuries. And I just kept reading and I recognized a lot of stuff that I knew from homebrewing. And then I just went on what German language literature is there, since that's my native language. And I just kept looking, found huge amounts of historic beer styles that were around. A lot of them aren't around anymore. Mm-hmm. And I actually published a book about that a few years ago, and then I think it started 5 years ago when I was specifically interested in Vienna Lager because I'd read about it in the context of craft beer, but I didn't know the style. It was not a thing that you could get in Austria at the time. And so I just started reading and starting to look into historic sources and just picked up a few bits and pieces, just wrote it in my blog, whatever I could find out, because I wanted to get to the bottom of the whole thing. What was Vienna Lager originally like? And then about 1.5 years ago, friends of mine basically nudged me and said, "Hey, you blogged actually quite a bit about Vienna Lager. Do you think you could write a whole book about it?" And I said, I can try. And I just kept looking into the whole topic more and more closely. And I found a lot of interesting and surprising stuff that really wasn't part of the narrative about Vienna Lager so far, that is not that well known, or that even I would say is counter to what people commonly think about Vienna Lager.
Mm-hmm. And obviously you published it in a book, which I think is available on Amazon, right?
That's right.
It's called Vienna Lager.
It's simply called Vienna Lager. Very easy to find.
Yeah.
And it was also the easiest way for me to publish it, because I didn't have to go through any big publisher or anything. Mm-hmm. Could just go the self-publishing route, which I think is a great way of publishing special interests about special interest topics nowadays.
Well, I mean, unlike some beers, Vienna Lager does have a definite origin to it. Can you tell us a little bit about the origin of it? And specifically, I think you talk in the book about the man who invented it, right?
Yeah. So the beer style very much goes back to what Anton Dreher has been doing. Anton Dreher is an Austrian brewer who was active in the 19th century. But to like specifically understand the origin of the beer style, we should look at like the very specific path Anton Dreher went as a brewer. So he grew up in a family that was very much rooted in brewing. So his father was originally from Schwabe, which is nowadays southwest Germany, and he moved to Austria. He was actually going to move like further down the river Danube, but he stopped in Austria for whatever reason. Started working as a waiter and cellarman, and then had enough money to rent a brew house. It was reasonably successful. Like, didn't get super rich, but with the earnings from the first rented brew house, he was able to buy another one, and then bought a second one, and I think he sold the first one, and the final brew house was the brewery Kleinschwechat, which was just outside of Vienna, and that was his brewery then. Anton Dreher's father died relatively young though, when Anton was just 10 years old, and Anton, so Anton's mother took over the brewery, and I think she rented it out to someone else in the family. And Anton, just as a boy, went through this very classic humanist secondary education in a Viennese boarding school, and then did an apprenticeship at another brewery in another suburb of Vienna called Simmering. At that time, brewing in the whole Vienna area was still top fermenting, with very few exceptions. Mm-hmm. And I think what's important to know here is also that beer was not a massively popular drink. Like wine and an Austrian kind of apple cider called Most were actually more popular. And the beer that was consumed in and around in Vienna was sometimes like imported from more western parts of Austria or even Bavaria. So the local beer did not have a good reputation. And so during this apprenticeship at the Simmering Brewery, Anton Dreher met Gabriel Sedlmayr, who was the son of the then owner of the Spaten Brewery in Munich, who was on a trip through Austria to study breweries and distilleries. And they got along really well. Apparently their initial meeting was just a few days. But they got along really well and they stayed in touch, and they came up with a plan. Yeah, we want to learn about English brewing, and we want to go to England and look at the hop gardens in Kent and all these things. And so they planned a trip. And then in 1833, they traveled to London. Gabriel Sedlmayr took two more friends with him. One was Georg Lederer from Nuremberg, another rather well-known Bavarian brewing family, and a fourth guy of whom I've only been able to find out the surname, called Neindl, who was also from Austria. And they came to London, rented a flat, tried to tour some breweries, but none of them would really let them in. So that was a problem, because Bavarian breweries or breweries like in Austria and Germany at that time were a lot more open to people from the industry. And so they had to find a way in. And so Anton simply took a job at Barclay Perkins just to learn about the brewing process. He was apparently just employed for a very brief period of time. And he did it only to get a better overview over the whole brewing process there. Then by pure chance, they met the brewing scientist called David Booth. It was actually Anton Dreher had bought a book, and in that book there was an ad with an address in London, and it said you could buy like brewing equipment, like small saccharometers and things like that. Mm-hmm. You could buy there, so they went there, and they got along really well. They had good discussions about brewing science or the state of the art of brewing science at that time. David Booth taught them a few things, it taught them about what attenuation is and how to actually use a saccharometer, which was quite a new thing for them, and was not a common tool for brewers in Germany at all. They also got some letters of reference from David Booth, so it was easier then for them to get into breweries, and so they started approaching this whole thing of looking at breweries and how they're brewing more systematically, and they had the idea of stealing samples of wort and fermenting beer, and they never really felt good about it, so they tried to they always felt like, okay, if they get caught, they might get beaten up and thrown out on the street or something. So they got a special walking stick with a valve underneath, so they could secretly take samples. Just put it in a fermenter, take a sample, then
of course they probably didn't know it at the time, but they were stealing the yeast as well, right?
Yeah, they probably didn't know so much about, or they probably didn't care so much about that. But I, from what I could gather, they very much did things like measuring specific gravities on samples. That's what they apparently did, and they also had like small thermometers that they held into fermenters and things like that. So they created this whole system of stealing samples and basically industrial espionage. And after some time, they went to Scotland. They went to Edinburgh, and there they met a brewer called John Moyer, and he actually gave them fairly open access to his brewery, so they could take lots of notes, look at the brewing process more in detail, and they actually learned a lot from that. And then New Year's Eve, 1833, they traveled back. Gabriel Telemeyer, he stayed back in France a bit more and took a bit of a longer route, and Antandrea went straight to Munich. Specifically saying, I want to use our stealing system also in Munich. And then they spent the winter there to basically do experiments, what they'd learned from their journey. And the biggest things they've learned were definitely British malting techniques. So the apparently slow sprouting and germination at low temperatures was something that was very specific in British malting, and where British maltsters were very particular about. The other thing was smoke re-kilning, which was something that was the state of the art in the UK back then.
Yeah, I mean, this was pretty early on, right? You mentioned 1830-ish. They were just making the transition. A lot of maltsters were making the transition from smoke, basically smoked malt, to coke fired malt or coke dried malt, which was much lighter in character. So,
yeah, and whereas in Germany and Austria, the vast majority of maltsters, brewers and maltsters, really were still on smoke kilns. And so one of the big innovations were the as they were called in Germany, English malt kilns. They were smoke-free. They called them English smoke kilns, but that was basically just an allusion to basically the high quality and the smokeless nature of British malt, which until I would say 1830s, 1840s was not very common in Germany at all for kiln malt.
So how did all this knowledge eventually evolve into a lager fermentation and also specifically the Vienna lager style?
Antandrea, he basically came back. He had all these ideas what he wanted to do, and he specifically said, "I want to improve the malt that we're making." And so he installed a smoke-free kiln to produce a fairly pale malt. That was one thing. The other thing was he he wanted to do Bavarian style decoction mashing, because he thought that was like the highest form of mashing.
So sort of maybe a double decoction or something like that.
Even triple decoction.
Triple like decoction.
Bavarian decoction mashing at that time was all about triple decoctions, very, very specifically. And so he had these two elements, and then he initially he initially brewed beer with the pale smoke-free malt and the decoction mashing, but he still used top fermenting yeast. But he then sent the letter to his friend Gabriel Siedlmeier. Could you send me a sample of your bottom fermenting yeast? And already in like late 1836 or early 1837, I couldn't pinpoint it closer. He started brewing bottom fermented beer.
That is very early for lager.
He did not do any lagering though. And that's an interesting detail. But he had no lagering space, so he had to send it out right after primary fermentation out to the pub cellars and basically leave it to the pub owner to hopefully mature it for long enough. But it was quite the success. So there's a letter that Anton Dreher sent to Gabriel Siedlmeier in March 1837, where he specifically says, I owe the rapid growth of my business in recent times to my bottom fermented beers. And that was March 1837, and that was probably just a fairly low alcohol beer. So we're talking probably 3.5% at most.
I just wonder, when did he actually produce something we would call a Vienna lager? I guess pretty close in 1837, right?
The time where he most definitely did it was 1840, because 1840 was the time where one of his neighbors offered to rent his wine cellar. So they took the opportunity and used that wine cellar to lager his beer. So he had control over it, and he produced it at a strength that was like what we would say was a proper lager back then. And 1840 with the first cellar that he had, that was also the point in time where he completely stopped brewing any top fermented beers. So until then, from 37 until from 1837 till 1840, during the summer he was still brewing his top fermented beers, and only during the winter doing the bottom fermented beers. But now with the cellar, he had a bit more space, and really could keep the beer to his own quality standards. And then in 1841, 1842 he really started investing and started building huge lagering spaces that were much, much bigger and could hold much more beer. And the business was absolutely booming.
And you mentioned the Bavarian techniques obviously influenced the development of Vienna lager. How did Vienna lager influence development of Czech lagers and also German styles?
With the Czech lagers, I would say the influence is a more subtle one. What definitely was a huge influence is the business success of Anton Dreher. Like his brewing business grew like crazy, and made bottom fermented beers really popular in Vienna and in more parts of Austria. At that time, some Czech brewers were already brewing bottom fermented beers. So the thing is, there had always been some bottom fermenting going on in Bohemia. But really only from the 1830s, 1840s on, more breweries tried to pick it up. Like one, like another very, very famous example is the Bürger Brauerei in Pilsen, which we now know as Pilsen Urquell. They hired a Bavarian brewer who then started a bottom fermentation with a very pale malt, and basically started the whole Pilsner beer style. But this industrialization of beer brewing that Antandrea started,
particularly lager production, right?
Yeah, I mean, totally kicked it off. And from the 1850s to the 1870s, Bohemia pretty much completely switched to bottom fermentation exclusively. So I would say that's one influence.
And then you mentioned Marzen, I think, was another style influenced, right?
Oh yeah, there the connection is like super clear, and we have it really well documented. So a bit of a background to that: Märzen used to be, like, Märzen in Munich specifically used to be the name for a lager beer that was usually enjoyed in the summer, up to the end of the 18th century, and there was a very association with a very particular kind of brewing organizational system. I haven't found a good English name. I just came up with turn brewing, because it was a brewing system where brewers were brewing in turns. So it was very anti-competitive, and they had a lottery system in place to determine basically who was brewing next. So that system, or that's where the Märzen beer term comes from in Munich or in Bavaria. But that system was abolished in the late 18th century, and was quite quickly forgotten. But in 1870, a son of somebody else from the Sedlmayr family, so the Sedlmayr family, they in total owned two breweries. One was Spaten, as I mentioned earlier. The other one was actually the older brother of Gabriel Sedlmayr. He owned the Franciscana brewery, I think also quite well-known brewery nowadays. And his son, he had done an apprenticeship in Antandrea's brewery, and came back and wanted to brew something like a Vienna lager, but a bit stronger. You could say it's kind of like a Vienna lager, but more as a Bock beer. So it had the original gravity roundabout of a Bock beer back in the day. And he brewed that in 1870. Then in 1871, he brewed it again. And at that time, there was an unusually hot summer. And one of the stall owners for Oktoberfest, he approached the brewery and said, I would like to have some beer for Oktoberfest. We're running out of our regular beer that we would be serving. I don't want to serve any young and weak beer that would be brewed for the winter. And by pure chance, Franciscana Brewery, they had this Vienna style lager or kind of Bock beer, still lagering. So they sampled it, and Schottenhammel, the stall owner, said, yeah, this is a great beer. I wanna serve this Oktoberfest, and he simply picked the name Märzen and reused that term, and the beer became really popular, and it became really like over the years that a special beer type just for the Oktoberfest.
Yeah. No, it's amazing. I've been to Oktoberfest, and it's an amazing beer and great to have in the fall. You know.
I have to admit I haven't been yet, but I've been to other few festivals in the general region. It's just a great kind of event and fun.
A lot of fun.
And yeah. And Märzen really like has the status of a real fest beer, like a beer just for the particular festival that you're going to.
Absolutely. And then in your book, you also mentioned that Vienna jumped across the Atlantic and ended up in the U.S. and Mexico, influencing a lot of beers here, right?
Mm. Yeah. And that was actually something when I did my research. I was very surprised about when I looked into it more closely, because the main association that people have with Vienna Lager is Mexico, and that's what you normally find. But when you look into the whole literature, you actually find a very strong connection of Vienna Lager and the United States. Like, from the 1870s on, German American brewers were brewing that kind of beer style. It was fairly popular. It was not the most popular beer, but it was still fairly popular. And you can find really lots of newspaper ads just for Vienna Lager or Vienna beer or Wiener beer similar names. And it was when you look at the brewing literature of that time, which was often written by German Americans and often published like in both in German and English, you often find Vienna Lager as one of the like three model beer types besides the Munich Dark Lager and the Pilsner. And at that time, American lager as a distinct type, I would say, still emerged when German brewers were still, you know, getting accustomed to really high protein 6-row barley malt and using them together with adjuncts like corn or rice. Because the differences between beer styles were not so clear back then. And so there are some sources that say that American lagers are kind of like Vienna lagers, but more highly attenuated, like drier and maybe a bit more bitter. But it shows the general understanding of what is a Vienna lager, what is typical for a Vienna lager, very much must have been there and must have been a common thing if you can use Vienna lager as a reference point to describe other beers. And it's a beer style that really kept on being brewed. I would say up to the prohibition, and after prohibition, you can still find it in some brewing literature, only occasionally as a product. What I found most interesting, apparently Coors had a golden export lager, which they described as like a Viennese type of beer, and they only stopped brewing it in 1950. And then in the 1970s, the early homebrewers picked up the beer style again. And Michael Jackson like briefly wrote about it. And I would say that's what made it part of this like canon of classic beer styles that we know nowadays. Whereas with Mexico, that country was actually quite late in picking up lager brewing, and they just had their unique challenges. First of all, the local population didn't really drink much beer. Most of the beer drinkers were like rich European immigrants or expats. And so the few brewers that started brewing, they had to struggle with the high temperatures. So for a very long time, bottom fermentation was completely out of the question. Many brewers just used local barley, which they malted themselves and dried in the sun. They didn't even use kilns. They used cane sugar as a brewing sugar. So it was not great. It was not great conditions to work with.
But they eventually developed their own style. One of the things I was interested in, you did an extensive study of historic recipes. How were some of the modern Vienna lagers that we enjoy today different from the historical examples that you researched and detailed in the book?
I would say, or maybe first of all, one big problem was that I was not able to find like a complete, concise recipe that traces back to the Kleinschwechter brewery. The problem there is, and Jeff Allworth found that out on a trip to Vienna last year, that even the brewery there, they don't have any old brewing records anymore. So it's just a reconstruction, but the reconstruction of this historic recipe is quite clear. It's super simple in ingredients. It's just one type of malt and one type of hops, but it's very process driven. It's a smash beer, single malt, single hops, but rather sophisticated triple decoction mashing.
Well, and of course, the malts probably weren't as highly modified, and the ingredients weren't quite at the same quality as we have today. I would imagine, right?
Apparently the barley, the specific barley variety, very very common and popular at that time, was considered to be of a fairly good quality, which was called Hanna, which is from Moravia, which is nowadays another part of the Czech Republic. Mm-hmm. It was probably very good for that time, and it was one of the, you know, really well known names, like how you would say Mary's Otter nowadays, or Chevalier was probably the of equivalent quality in the UK, but it still formed a basis for newer varieties that were bred. So I would say that there's definitely a big or there have been definitely big steps forward to produce even better suited barley varieties.
Well, we don't have too much time left, but I was hoping we could maybe walk us through a simple Vienna lager recipe, what it looks like, what yeast you use, typical hops, and so on, for the homebrewers out there that are interested in producing this particular style.
Yeah, I would say, like for a super traditional Vienna lager, just go with a 100% Vienna malt. That's what the brewery originally used. They also brewed it like a lower strength draft beer, where they added a little bit of roasted malt, just a tiny amount, but they kept it simple. They produced their own malt exactly for their purpose, and that's what they stuck to. For a more modern version, I would say, you know, it's up to the brewer's preference. I still prefer a large amount of Vienna malt as a base malt, just for the overall flavor. Like people are free to do as they like.
Mm-hmm. And the hops, you mentioned grain bill is 100%, right?
Yeah. So for hops, I would go with Saaz hops. It's the main variety that Anton Dreher used. He in the late 1850s. Bought a brewery in Bohemia that is in the Saaz region, where he basically next to the brewery had his own hop garden and grew quite a significant amount of hops. So Saaz hops are definitely the right choice. I would say for if you wanted to go for a more modern interpretation, any kind of noble hop character is still fairly traditional. So of course Saaz, like Hallertauer, Mittelfrüh, Spalter, Tettnanger. Mm-hmm. I think it's also, if you want to experiment more, there are now these modern varieties that are basically bred as modern successors of old hop varieties, like with names like Saphir, Perle, Smaragd, Opal, Diamant. But I have to say I haven't tried any of them, but I've read great things, and I think there's a lot of space to experiment with newer hop varieties.
And your preference for yeast?
For yeast, just like for the historic version, you want a low attenuating one to get the right attenuation, which makes the beer, I would say, fairly sweet, which can make it unusual or unexpected. But for a more modern approach, and that's how I also prefer them, is just a W3470, for example, just to dry the beer out enough to make it not cloying. And I mean, there aren't, personally, I don't see that many differences in different yeast strains. So, but just go with whatever you prefer.
And then, do you do any special mash techniques? Do you actually go through a decoction? Have you tried that?
I personally do all my lager brewing with decoction. I do not do the whole triple decoction because I have I noticed that with the normal triple decoction, protein rests are way too long, and I never ever got good foam stability. So I'm doing a compromise where I'm doing a double decoction, where initially I take a very large decoction of 2/3 of the whole mesh. And the first decoction I heat up to 70 degrees, which, God, I don't know how much that is in Fahrenheit. So basically,
just we can convert for it.
For a saccharification, just briefly for 15 minutes, then bringing it to a boil and then mixing it back. And that brings it into an area of 65 degrees Celsius. So I wrote that down. It's 149 Fahrenheit. And it skips the protein rest, or basically limits it just to a very brief period of heating up the first decoction, and then just do the second decoction. That has worked really well. I think it brings in a lot of decoction character because it's quite an intense first boil, but it does not cause any, or at least to me, it has not caused any foam stability issues. But for if you brew it at home, I would say a normal multi-step infusion mesh is perfectly fine, like something like Hochkurz or so, that doesn't do too much protein rest. If you're lazy, single step infusion mesh is probably fine as well.
And then fermentation, do you do anything special during fermentation for it?
I simply pitch, like personally, I pitch a large amount, a healthy dose of yeast at 10 degrees Celsius and just let it ride. And then when fermentation is finished, I simply reduce the temperature. What I said with the low attenuating yeasts, although historically were used, they had them fermenting at extremely low temperatures, and then lagered them for months and months at just a few degrees above freezing. But it's just a slightly different variety of yeast that nowadays practically doesn't make so much more sense. And I talked to somebody from a yeast lab, and they said, yeah, these they're called Sarza type yeasts. They're great when it comes to working at cold temperatures. They're just working really well at cold temperatures. But they produce a lot of diacetyl, and they're not practical in modern brewers at all, and that's why nobody uses them anymore.
So any final tips for somebody looking to brew the perfect Vienna lager?
I'm not sure there is a perfect Vienna lager. I personally prefer a fairly traditional one, that is basically just Vienna malt and Saaz hops, to a fairly normal strength. I like it a bit more on the bitter side. So I've brewed one with 40 IBU, and that has worked surprisingly well. But I would say it's something where you can experiment. As I already said, you can try out different hop varieties. It's something if you use small amounts, like certain specialty malts, can probably bring in a bit of extra complexity. I just wouldn't overdo it. But there's a lot you can play with.
And Andreas, before we go, I wanted to mention your blog. Could you perhaps share the address for your blog as well as where to find the new book?
Okay, my blog is called daftegypt.com. I probably need to
spell that out.
I need to spell it out. That's daftegypt.com. It's basically my wife's from Northern Ireland, and it was a kind of an endearing term of, you know, the of a stupid idiot, but in a friendly kind of way. And she started calling me that at some point, and so I simply took that as a name for my blog. And my book, I mean, I can show it here to the camera.
Ah, nice.
That's what it looks like. You can just get that on Amazon worldwide. Just search for the title Vienna Lager. I think it comes on as the first hit. It's available as an ebook and as printed book. I think I'm selling it for a moderate price. I'm not in it to make lots and lots of money with that book.
You're not going to retire in the Bahamas.
So there is not much money to be made with beer literature. I'm just trying to get the word out, and I think as you could hear, I'm enthusiastic about Vienna Lager, and I'm trying to get my enthusiasm to everyone. And that was one of the reasons why I wrote that book.
Well, Andreas, I wish you great success with your book and appreciate you coming on the show. I'm always interested in historical brewing. Mm-hmm. So thank you again.
Oh, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
And again, my guest today was Andreas Krenmeier, author of the new book, Vienna Lager. Great having you. Thanks again.
Thank you.
A big thank you to Andreas Krenmeier for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also the Brew Commander, the new complete brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a digital brewhouse controller with high precision and the ultimate in flexibility. The Brew Commander offers automated step mashing, boil timers, and advanced brew day settings. Command your brew day with the new Brew Commander from Blickman Engineering. To order your today, go to blickmanengineering.com. Again, that's blickmanengineering.com. And finally, I urge you to give Beersmith 3 Brewing Software a try. I've recently released the new Beersmith 3.1 desktop update, which includes improved data storage, additional dry hop options, new mash pH models, and much more. To download a free 21-day trial version, go to beersmith.com today. Again, that's beersmith.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.